from 94.9 KUOW. Not a bird, not a plane. I'm Marcy Silman, and this is The Week in Review. President Obama's in St. Petersburg, Russia right now. He's meeting with the world's leaders, trying to persuade them to join the United States in military action against Syria. Closer to home, Governor Jay Inslee is ready to do a little horse trading in order to get lawmakers back to Olympia to talk about transportation funding. It's Friday, and our panel of journalists is here once again to talk about these and other stories making headlines. All super people. Peter Jackson, not birds, not planes, super people.
Just super people, but super he knows people. Airplanes.
Yeah. Yeah. Peter Jackson, editorial page editor for the Everett Herald. Nice to have you back. Eli Sanders, associate editor for The Strangers here, and so is that voice you just heard, Joni Balter, assistant political editor for The Seattle Times. Nice to have you here on this very wet Friday. You're all dry, so I'm assuming, Eli, maybe you didn't ride your bicycle.
Not this morning.
Well, let's go back about a week. President Obama surprised a lot of people last Saturday when he went out into the Rose Garden to make a speech, and a lot of people had thought the president was going to announce a military strike. But instead, he sent the whole issue of intervention in Syria over to Congress, which is something that a lot of people had wanted. But there's a lot of ways to characterize it. Do you guys think it was a punt or was it a politically savvy move? I'll start with you.
I'd like to think it was a fairly politically savvy move in the sense that he's kind of changed the paradigm now. I mean, future military action, there's going to be this focus on going to Congress.
Shouldn't there be?
Congress
thought so.
Yeah. Well, and there's been this kind of wink and nod on the War Powers Resolution for so many years. So in many ways, I mean, it caught folks by surprise, whether or not it was prompted by David Cameron's move.
It seems like Britain prompted this because he was going full force until that vote, which held back Britain from participating. And, you know, it's not an easy decision for a president. He spent how much time going around Congress? You know, Congress, that annoying thing I have to deal with sometimes. Congress, the thing I go out to the American people on guns. I go to the American people on health care. And so all of a sudden, here's Obama, and he's saying, oh, I'm going to check in with Congress. And he did have a letter from 200 members of Congress saying, we want to talk about this.
You know, he's a constitutional law professor. He's someone who ran for the presidency campaigning against dumb wars, against interventions in the Middle East that are not fully thought out. And yes, there was a kind of push or sense of rush from him at the beginning. But whatever the reason, whatever slowed him down, I think he made the constitutionally correct choice. As Peter was saying, there's been this trend over many years of going to war without congressional authorization or going around Congress. And that's actually not how things are supposed to go. We're seeing why right now, because it's not easy to get Congress to agree on anything, particularly this Congress, and it's not quick. So
no.
So we'll see where it goes. The Washington State delegation, of course, is pretty negative by my reading on the idea of authorizing force. Both Senator Murray and Senator Cantwell, who will be up first because the Senate is going first on this, have expressed very deep misgivings. It'll be interesting to see where they ultimately land. Senator Murray voted against the Iraq War. Senator Cantwell voted for it and then came around and offered this kind of qualified, very measured apology for that. But both of them, I would be surprised to see them endorse an attack on Syria.
Well, here you go. Patty Murray, of course, is in leadership. It's going to be a very difficult vote for her to come out and say, I don't support the president. She's, you know, in leadership.
She's supposed to support the president.
She's supposed to, and you can go on the other side of the ledger and look at Kathy McMorris Rogers, the Republican who's from Spokane, also in leadership, and her captain, John Boehner, has said that he would support the action, so that they all have a very tortured route to a vote.
Well,
they all have that.
Well, that's what's so interesting about this, because this isn't going to fall on party lines, I don't think. I'm not sure what kinds of lines people are going to split on. And a lot of the congressional response I've seen is based on public input and the American people. By and large, don't support this. We got an interesting email from our listener, Aaron, who said she did a sort of a shout out on a loop a social polling app that she made, and she heard from 363 people, which is a pretty good response. 24% of those people supported an airstrike, but only if they've got international allies, which is a next subject to talk about. 15% support an airstrike unilaterally if need be. 5% say to arm the Syrian rebels, which is another whole can of worms. 17% say non-military action. 17% say do nothing. And then there's the I don't know group, which is about 25% of her respondents.
Well, if you looked at that summary, I believe it was in the New York Times, and you, Mr. Peter, tweeted this.
Mm.
The public is maybe with the Congress, or the Congress is with the public, however you want to phrase that, because undecided wins on this one. At the moment.
It's going to be really fascinating to watch this debate. And people like Rick Larson and other members of Congress are sending out, I want to say, their version of polling emails saying, tell me, American people, what or my constituents, what you want mm-hmm. me to do. And there's something a little bit concerning about that, because you're dealing with a decision that in some ways is morally unambiguous. And you kind of hope that it's not going to be based on public sentiment.
But many members of Congress, so Debbie Wasserman Schultz is from Florida, a Democrat, very active Democrat, and she happens to have the highest number of Holocaust survivors in her district. And she mentioned this as she said that she was going to support the president on this because she's heard from them, the never again, you know, this kind of genocide.
Yeah, that's what makes it so complicated. I mean, it's... In terms of, you know, is this going to be normative now that we don't take any kind of action in the face of something like a nerve gas attack? And that's what I think people find so troubling, even people who are, you know, viscerally against any kind of military action. We have to do something in terms of whether it's refugee assistance, whether it's some kind of military assistance to the rebels.
Now, last week, Eli, you said that the Slog, I think, had done some shout-outs. Has the newspaper been following along with that?
Well, I've been blogging about Syria every day on our blog Slog every morning, and I did two polls last week, one on Monday to see where people were on the idea of a Syria intervention, and something like 80% of Slog readers were opposed. By Friday of last week, it was up to 85%. Then this week, I did another poll after the Senate Foreign Relations Committee passed their authorization, which reined in what President Obama could do. It said that he couldn't put boots on the ground, that he had a limited time frame, 60 days or maybe 90 days. They gave an extension.
Right.
And so when I did that, the support increased a little bit, or I guess I should say the opposition on Slog ticked
decreased
down from 85% to 80%, but that is still resoundingly opposed. And so we're seeing what other people are seeing, incredibly strong opposition to this around the country, but also heightened opposition here in Seattle. But the point that Peter's making is important. This is a representative democracy. These are representatives. They don't have to vote exactly how the majority of people in their district feel. And in fact, that's not the way our system is designed. It's designed to let them vote their conscience. Our representatives vote for what they think is best. And that is the sort of wrenching decision that the representatives have to make. I think it was very shrewd politically for Obama to force every member of Congress to make this decision, because had he not, they would be able to say retroactively whatever they wanted about how they might have voted, because hypothetical.
And now they can't.
And yeah, so he could have been criticized no matter what, and they would probably, some of them would misrepresent, you know, what they actually would have done for political gain. And now it gets everyone on the record, which will be helpful.
Everyone was talking about how lonely the decision is for President Obama without Congress and without Britain, just that he's been so lonely. And I couldn't help but notice that he went and he got a second dog. And as you know what they say in D.C., if you're lonely, if you need a friend, get a dog. So he now has two.
So that they could give him unswerving support on his stand on Syria. We're talking over the week's news with Joni Balter, Peter Jackson, Eli Sanders. Now, you mentioned how terribly lonely the president has been on this. Right now, he's in St. Petersburg, and Last I saw, he had actually sat down somewhere to talk to Vladimir Putin about this, which was surprising because there was a lot of chit-chat after the plane landed about who was touching whose elbow and how far apart they were sitting at state dinners. But there is the framework of economic discussion that they are supposed to be doing. And underneath, the president is there on a lobbying trip. I mean, he's there to twist all his allies' arms and even the people who aren't his allies who we provide money to say, stand with me. And I'm curious how successful that will be. Canada says, we'll stand, but we're going to be in the background.
We're going to stand way in the back if you can find us.
Yeah, you know. We like you, but no.
But he did meet with Putin for 20 minutes, and the interpreter that was summing it up said something like, it was cordial, we did not change each other's minds, but we found we can talk about other things, other approaches that we, the humanitarian side, that we might agree on.
There's sort of a tragedy of the commons going on here. You were talking about Canada saying we support the idea of drawing some sort of line about the use of chemical weapons, but we're not going to do something about it. And President Obama has kind of alluded to this in some of his statements, that he gets a lot of world leaders saying, yeah, we think something should be done, but we're not going to do it. You do it. And so this is, again, the conundrum. Does this require action? And also, you know, a lot of the debate that I've been reading online focuses on the actual inconsistency of our action over time. This is not something that the world has always and forever acted against, or even the United States has always and forever acted against. But what the president is arguing is that, yes, that's the past. This is something that it's in the world interest and in the United States' own interest to enforce this prohibition against the use of chemical weapons. And so he feels there has to be some action taken. The most compelling counterargument I find to that is, well, what happens after the action? What's the reaction, and what's our next action? That's the problem, and that can't be foretold and hasn't been, you know, sort of explained very well.
Well, everybody wants to know the plan, and people like Dianne Feinstein and others who've seen the intelligence and say there is a plan. It's more along the lines of, well, I could tell you, but I can't tell you because it's all confidential. And so you have the immediate vacuum and trust.
I should say that President Obama is scheduled to speak to the nation on Tuesday, and the time is not yet pinned down. And even if there is one, they never quite pin the time down. So we'll be running that speech live, and we'll let you know what time that is exactly. But I am curious, before we take a little break here, whether each of the three of you thinks the president will go ahead if Congress votes against it, because he does have that option.
Well, he said that he didn't want to sort of jeopardize the congressional proceedings by saying what he would do if he comes up short. If he comes up short, it would most likely be in the House. The Senate looks like it's going his way. We do have to note that the timing of his speech, his appeal to the public, because he's, you know, the public is, the support is not there, but he's going to use the bully pulpit on Tuesday, the night before September 11th, which has a certain momentousness to it.
I would be surprised, but not totally shocked, if he went ahead without congressional authorization. But what a very, very strange place for Obama to find himself in. After the way he ran initially for the presidency, to now find himself in his second term going to war, potentially, without congressional authorization.
Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, and I agree with Eli that in all likelihood he probably will do something. But having the split between the Senate and the House, I think you can even use that as a pretext to move ahead.
We're talking over the week's news. Peter Jackson is editorial page editor for the Everett Herald. Eli Sanders is associate editor for The Stranger. And Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. I'm Marcy Silman. This is KUOW.
I'm Bob Garfield. On this week's On the Media, the man who documented Washington's ongoing incest among media celebrities and pals was reporting from the inside.
One criticism has been that I violated an unwritten rule in which insiders should not speak critically of other insiders. I will plead totally guilty to that.
Author Mark Leibovich talks out of school. Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Sunday night at 6 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Support for KUOW comes from the Vashon Sheepdog Classic, a sheep herding competition on the hills of Misty Isle Farms with local foods, crafts, and an interactive fiber arts area. September 13th, 14th, and 15th. Proceeds benefit Island Youth Programs. Details at VashonSheepdogClassic.com.
64 degrees in Seattle with scattered showers, expecting rain off and on through the day, tapering off this afternoon, and a high of 67. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:22.
This is the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. We're talking with Joni Balter of the Seattle Times, The Strangers, Eli Sanders, and joining us from the Everett Herald, Peter Jackson. We talked globally, and this is still sort of a global story. This week, we got the news that Microsoft was spending millions of its stashed away dollars to buy the Finnish device company. I think that's how they're positioning it now. Nokia. They make phones, but they don't call them that anymore. We call them devices. And at the announcement of this purchase, because you guys were asking me in the break, Microsoft stock actually went down. Nokia's went up, which I thought was interesting. I don't know what that means. But a bigger question that people had was whether Elop, the leader of Nokia, was also being purchased and maybe auditioned to take over for Steve Ballmer.
I didn't get that so much, but possibly because they are on this this search. That, you know, remember Ballmer said that he would stay up to 12 months, assuming that a national and perhaps international search could take that long. There was a fascinating detail about the negotiations between Microsoft and Nokia, that then when they were meeting back during Memorial Day, that Steve Ballmer fell over this glass table. And, you know, while they were having...
In Finland,
the meeting was in London, and they were, you know, they were talking about the details, and he was engrossed in reading the details, kind of like the way some people walk around with their cell phones, in case you haven't noticed. But he was reading a document about the sale and doesn't see a glass table. He's a big, tall guy. He goes flying over it, and there are injuries to report. But anyway, the deal proceeded, which is, you know... cool that the deal could go through after all that.
It's interesting to think about Microsoft's evolution, because this announcement, you know, not even a month ago that Ballmer would leave, and just a few months before that, that the company was going to reorganize drastically and rebrand itself as a services and device company as opposed to a software maker. You know, you got to wonder, they employ a lot of people in our region. And, you know, if I worked for Microsoft, I might be kind of sitting around over there thinking, gosh, all the Boeing jobs are leaving. What about mine?
The whole thing is also just another reminder of how much catch-up Microsoft is playing. It went out and bought, you know, the third place maker of smartphone technology, which is way behind Android and Apple, in an attempt to very belatedly catch up with this market that has left it behind. So I think that may be one of the things that you're seeing in the stock price action or activity for Microsoft after this. It just reminds again, like with tablets, that they were left behind as the market went elsewhere, and think that they can kind of buy their way into a top position again.
They have a lot of money offshore in their savings account, and it's hundreds of billions, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, it's like an untold wealth that's sitting there. So it's interesting. They probably could buy their way in, if one could buy one's way into this
question
business.
And they haven't actually, they've tried this in the past, I think, and it hasn't worked.
The buying in.
Right.
Well, remember they said...
Look at Bing.
Yeah.
They said devices and services. So they go out and buy...
Some devices.
Some devices. So that is at least on point.
You're right about that. Just a related business question. This, I'm not sure if it affects the Boeing plant up in your neck of the woods, Peter. But again, more engineering jobs being outsourced from the Puget Sound region to California from Boeing.
Yeah, it's very disappointing. And especially now that we're ramping up engineering programs in Snohomish County, people are very excited. There's a WSU branch.
Right.
You know, just focusing on mechanical engineering. And I mean, that's... that's been the focus of not only the local economic alliance, but community leaders. And so this whole issue of we're not producing enough STEM grads and engineering students is bogus, or at least it's something that the trend, we're working against that trend. So I think it's discouraging, and all of this is leading up to the 777X decision, which is probably going to come around the same time as the Dubai Air Show. I don't know when the Dubai Air Show is.
Are you going?
Do they send you?
The Herald does send us.
It's, really?
No.
Wow.
Yes, that's a new expense.
Yeah, no.
New Costco.
They'll send us down the street to the bar where
we can
it's, on
watch
t-
it.
It's being broadcast on cable. So this is a difficult time and a real transition period, and folks are nervous because the feeling is this is sort of out of their control, no matter all of the good intentions and all of the good policies.
Well, I think it's interesting the point about the STEM and the graduates, because we're also hearing that there's not enough software developers for the software industry to recruit in our area, and that's sort of code for, well, we can get the foreign workers to come in and take those jobs. But the past governor, Gregoire, had really advocated, and I think Inslee campaigned on, sort of putting a campus, putting WSU in Snohomish County, beefing up these technical training programs so that we'd have local people to take the jobs, and now there are no jobs to take,
or at least
in that area.
And again, Snohomish County's done a first-rate job. We had the presidents of Edmonds and Everett Community Colleges in, and they're working in partnership with the Aerospace Alliance and these other groups. So, again, they're doing everything possible to produce that whole, what's essentially become a talking point of the best-educated workforce. Mm-hmm. So, dang it, Boeing better...
Well, there is
better embrace it.
There is a little bit of a drip, drip, drip quality to the announcements that we've been seeing.
300 jobs here.
There is small numbers generally, but there's a sort of a repeat quality to the announcements.
Eli?
In terms of what we're doing with our education here in the state, we're not doing everything we can, actually. The Supreme Court has said we're not even doing constitutionally enough, and the Republican Party in the state, which supposedly is pro-business, is refusing to allow the state legislature to raise revenue that could be used to improve our state education system, which could then produce more of the people that Microsoft wants to hire. So we're actually very far from doing everything that we can to improve that situation. And this will be a problem that the legislative session will have to tackle yet again when they meet in January.
And that's a key point, because one of the things we learned from David Beyer from Everett Community College is that the need continues to be so great, but the K-12 education is where they're really at fault. They're just not they're not stepping up in terms of being prepared for STEM education.
We're talking about the week's news with Peter Jackson, editorial page editor for the Everett Herald, Eli Sanders, associate editor for The Stranger, and Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. And since you brought up the legislature, I have to talk about Governor Inslee's I'm not quite sure what it was. It's deal making. I will
gambit.
I will give up the Columbia River crossing, the thing that I said I absolutely had to have in my transportation package, if you lawmakers will come back, deliver me your Republican votes and a transportation package with revenue enhancement, which means taxes.
And so again, we see this same problem that the Republican Party in Olympia, under the leadership of Rodney Tom in the Senate, is just basically across the board refusing to raise meaningful revenue. And as Inslee put it in his press conference, they are now on the wrong side of the business community in the state, which sees a need for improved and increased transportation infrastructure in order to grow, and sees the problem as being that the state can't find any revenue for it. Now, the question is, and Inslee is I think, smartly putting this question first, are the Republicans willing to come back to Olympia and make a deal? Because they haven't been, and there's no point in actually calling this special session unless they will.
Tony?
So I was going to say that I think this is so back at you for Jay Inslee to say to the folks who stymied the transportation package that had been put together. Just to recap a sec, that was a 10.5 cent per gallon increase that did not make it through the legislature. And you have to remember, when Rodney Tom, the state senator from Medina, who is a Democrat, switched parties, Didn't switch parties this time, but I'm talking about...
He was a Republican. Now he's a Democrat.
Who is effectively a Republican.
But yes. He went to work, shall we say, with the Republicans. The idea was... Thank you for all that assistance. the idea was for him to sort of represent a suburban, moderate kind of position, a position that the business community might agree with. And so the day after Inslee announced that he might call a special session, the Washington Roundtable tweeted that they would love to see this happen because they would love to see a transportation package that would help much of the Puget Sound area. But what stymied the package, some of what stymied the package to start with, if you remember, State Senator Don Benton from Vancouver was elected by something, I forget what the final count, but it was in the less than 100 votes.
Right.
And he absolutely does not want light rail on the Columbia River crossing. So that became the problem for this package. And the question through the whole session was, was Rodney Tom with this majority coalition, was he really in control of the legislature, or was Mark Schessler of Ritzville and sort of the more rural part of the party? Who was in control of the legislature? Because this transportation package is very much aimed at the Puget Sound region. And a Vancouver senator ended up sort of leading the way to not have a package.
There's two things that I want you guys to answer for me, because I don't know. And the big one came from Everett Herald columnist Jerry Kornfield, mm-hmm. who we talked to about this earlier in the week, which is the effectiveness of Inslee. You were talking about this being a come back at you from Jay Inslee, but one thing that he didn't show himself to be particularly effective with during the legislative sessions that we underwent over this last year was lobbying his cause. He kind of did a lot of, press conferences, political speech making, and Gregoire seemed to be much more adept at the backroom deals. And so is that a accurate perception? Do you think that's Jerry's perception?
Yeah, I think it's a very accurate perception, in part, too, because the governor, even though he does have this bully pulpit, I don't think it's in his nature to be doing the arm twisting. He can in his own sort of Democratic caucus, but not with Republicans. So I think there is this natural tendency to, if not grandstand, then at least to kind of present his position through the media. But he may win on this because he's calling their bluff. And you not only have the Washington Roundtable, you have the Washington Labor Council. And it looks like they have to do something. So they're going on this speaking tour, and it may, in all likelihood, be fluff. But the question now is, will this special session actually come to pass? The consensus is it would be November.
Yes.
But
mm-hmm.
they would have to have a plan. Of
they wouldn't
time.
Come back without the votes.
Well, no, yeah. right, exactly. He says he won't call them without the votes.
Right.
Yeah.
It's worth saying that the January, February, March, April legislative session was Inslee's first. And so he may not have been as adept at reading the state legislature. Remember, he hadn't spent a lot of time in Olympia, but he had spent quite a bit of time in Congress, where that's all they do is twist arms yeah. and trade favors and so on. So I'm not sure it's right to say that he doesn't know how to do this. And I think there is something that's going to be very helpful to him, at least if he's kind of new to pulling the strings in Olympia, in calling a special session focused on one issue. Mm-hmm. There is a very clarifying effect to that, as opposed to the legislative session, where you have so much being thrown at the wall at once, even though, you know, we would always say there are one or two big votes that rise above the rest. They kind of can get lost in the clamor of so many other things. And so we're talking about one thing, transportation, and maybe raising the gas tax. And that should hopefully have a clarifying effect.
The Republicans are on a statewide tour. It starts next week, I believe, and they'll be meeting, I think, two meetings in this part of the state and then two meetings in eastern Washington, where I guess they're just like Congress. They're hearing from their constituents. You know, do you want a big tax increase?
You know, that's not the worst thing you can do, to go out and listen to what folks are saying. I mean, it's sort of a low calorie investment. You don't burn too many doing that. You're listening. And that's a way to come back and say, when I was out talking to the folks, this is what they wanted. And maybe it's even a face-saving thing, where you could come back and say, you know, I didn't realize the demand was so big, or it changed. To the point about Inslee, yes, he's very new. And he may have also thought that the business community would work its magic in the Senate. I'm not certain of that. I'm just wondering.
you know, a listening tour can also be a way of ducking making hard decisions, because the other thing that Republicans could be doing right now is going out on a persuasion tour and talking about their actual plan for improving the transportation system, if they had one, and persuading their constituents. The Democratic senator who came forward with a transportation package earlier this year, I believe she was a senator, I'm forgetting her name now, said in one of the reports I was reading about this, you know, fine, call a legislative session, but don't call it unless the Republicans are going to come and propose a plan, because I'm not going to sit there and just let them have no
ideas. That was Judy Cliburn.
Judy Cliburn.
Of Mercer
have no
Island
ideas
State,
of their own. Yeah. So Judy Cliburn was saying, I'm not going to just let them have no ideas of their own and pick apart mine.
The other part, I mean, the state business leaders want improved infrastructure here in King County, and I believe also Snohomish and Pierce were also talking about extension of local taxing authority, not a tax, but just the ability to ask voters if they would pay for a tax to help fund transit. If we don't get that in King County, we're losing, I believe, 17% of our bus service.
That's why the press conference that Inslee had was with Dow Constantine,
right,
because Constantine has a message he wants to get out, that one of the components of the transportation package was this vehicle renewal tax fee, whatever, I don't know, tax fee, and that that was a way to not have to proceed with the cuts for Metro Transit, which are significant.
Yeah.
And, you know, we see once again that a matter that connects not to the city of Seattle actually directly in terms of the governing structure, but to the county and to Olympia will become, I think, a line drawn directly to the mayor's race as we head toward November, because this debate about whether to call a special session and can Olympia stave off these huge and very, very painful cuts to bus service that is really going to impact Seattleites is going to be churning throughout the mayor's race. And then the question will become, Ed Murray, who was in Olympia, could he have done more to stave this off?
That question's already been floating. Is Snohomish County also looking at extending local taxing authority for community transit?
I believe so. But it's not as compelling an issue for Snohomish County as it is for
Is Snohomish County, County facing bus cuts?
Yes, some bus cuts.
Okay. And Tacoma, Pierce County.
Yes.
And, you know, the original transportation package, except for Highway 9 and the Snohomish River Bridge, there was nothing in it for Snohomish County. And not that you have to be too parochial about it, but usually with a far-sighted plan, you'll know who is taking the votes and why you have to make sure that you spread the mustard or whatever the
toothpaste.
Yeah, toothpaste.
Or the coconut cream pie. Peter Jackson, editorial page editor for the Everett Herald. Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Eli Sanders, associate editor for The Stranger. All with us here in the KUOW studios. I'm Marcy Simon. We're going to take a break and continue our conversation in a minute or so.
Everybody wants an open, transparent government, but it's kind of weird to get one. In Congress this week, the Democrats reconciled their loyalty to the president and their hatred of wars by protesting their own hearings. Have I no shame? I'm Peter Sagal, and I demand the police remove me from this room, but not from the news quiz, from NPR.
That's tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
KUOW's fall membership drive begins October 7th, and we're looking for donations of prepared food and snacks to feed our phone volunteers. A food donation is a great way to support KUOW and the news and information you rely on each day. To learn more, email volunteer at kuow.org.
Showers across the Seattle area. Currently 64 degrees, expecting to reach 67 this afternoon with the rain tapering off later. It's 10:40. I'm Bernard Ouellette. As the Senate prepares to vote on a resolution authorizing President Obama to use military force in Syria, we'll check in with Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont. He's among the skeptics in Congress. Talk with Bernie Sanders about Syria in 25 minutes.
This is KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Marcy Silman with our panel of journalists, Peter Jackson of the Everett Herald, The Stranger's Eli Sanders, and Joni Balter from the Seattle Times. We were talking about transportation, and now we can talk about the other big state issue. This week, the State Liquor Control Board came out with yet another set of draft regulations for pot. Our new version 3.0, I think, of the marijuana regulations, maybe 4.0. I've lost track in there.
All I could think of was Baskin and Robbins. You know, it's like all these stores, all these flavors, everywhere you look, there it is.
334 stores. Seattle's going to get the
21, I think.
21 stores, 61 slated for King County, and more than 30, I think, in Snohomish County, if I'm not mistaken.
I think that may be
you guys don't even want them, do you?
Well, Everett probably doesn't want them. I can't speak for South County. They have a different sense of
it. But Everett doesn't want any stores.
No. I'm sure Everett wants stores. And I think once the ball gets rolling on this and people recognize that both the demand and the revenue.
Or whatever it is.
Yeah. I mean, the revenue, is, of course, still the big issue with this. But yeah, we'll see what happens. I think King County is going to be in the vanguard.
One of the big questions is actually about demand and whether it will outstrip the supply that the state is allowing.
Because they capped the amount. How much? It was
25% of what they estimate to be the, if I'm hearing this right, the total demand.
Right. So where's the rest of it? I was confused about
medical
that.
Medical and
black market.
And black market,
well,
I think.
Well, that's the question. And they said, you know, this is kind of a crystal ball sort of thing. They're apparently doing all kinds of calculations to figure this out. But the quote I saw is it's kind of a razor's edge calculation where they're trying to provide just enough that they discourage people from going to the black market and not so much that it becomes an export business for people where they're taking it out of state, because remember that was...
We're not allowed to have leakage.
Right. That was the major, or one of the major conditions laid down by the DOJ.
Right.
But there probably would be political leakage, because Oregon was talking this week about how what the Department of Justice had said about pot and its sort of non-response to the two states was that, wow, that sort of like tells them that they might be successful in 2014 in Oregon.
I can't see why not.
With the pot stores, which is interesting, is it's hard to keep these state legislators from going, ooh, revenue party. And then it's up against the zoning, because each community you're talking about, Everett, is going to say, can't be 1,000 feet from a school, can't be 1,000 feet from a park. And so it really is a push me, pull you between these two interests, because the state wouldn't mind the money to pay for things like education or...
But in a way, this is not a problem. Let local communities decide whether they're going to fight this or not. It's not entirely clear whether it is legal for certain communities to effectively prohibit pot stores. And I think everyone's saying you will eventually have litigation about this in University Place and other places where they are where they are zoning them out. But for now, I don't know. To me, it seems to be a good fit for the sensibilities of the different counties. King County, which really wants it and has a lot of people who really want it, gets the lion's share of the stores, and other counties don't, and other cities are making it hard and fine.
I wonder how many stores are going to be in Clark County, which is going to be right on the Oregon border.
Oh, that's
and
interesting.
I assume
there's going
to put them on the Columbia River crossing. And
yeah.
that violates the leakage.
Violates the leakage. But yeah. But nevertheless, I think there's going to be.
That's a good question. Yeah. And I wonder if there's a prohibition. You know, it can't be X number of miles from the border.
No. Well, you know, it is really interesting. And these regulations came down just a week after the feds and Eric Holder finally said, OK, we're not going to challenge you. And so go ahead. And OK, we'll go ahead. But the one other odd thing, I guess not odd, it made sense, was something that was new in this set of rules, 3.0 rules, was something like the what they used to have from the FCC about owned and operated, the O&O rules for broadcasting. You can only have three licenses. You cannot have a monopoly. You can have one retail, one processing, and one distribution or one growing. So they're capping it. In other words, they don't want to see a Rupert Murdoch of pot.
Yeah.
Which I found pretty fascinating myself.
And fits with the sort of ethos, at least in Seattle, of supporting smaller operations, smaller businesses.
Mom and pop.
Mm. Yeah.
But pot dealership.
It also fits with the idea that as Inslee said, we're here to experiment and show that it can not get out of hand, that it can be done within the rules that the federal government seemed to say were essential. So by limiting the number of operations you could be involved in, it's a way of saying it's not going to get too big for any one individual.
You know, for all the talk about the state not being able to get any big projects done and stoners not being able to agree on anything very quickly, here is an incredibly large state project that is coming in on time, right? They were told.
The demand is high.
Then the interest is very high. But this is something that the state so far is doing right. We'll see how the implementation goes.
We're talking over the week's news. Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, Peter Jackson with us. And often, Peter, when you are not here, we have three Seattle journalists in the room. And so we need to talk about the Seattle mayor's race, which is always sort of percolating under the surface. But before I throw the bone to Joni, who loves to talk about this thing, I'm curious if anybody, I'm interested in talking about it. Does anybody in Everett care who's the mayor of Seattle?
Oh, probably, I want to say not really, but I do think they appreciate mayors who have a regional vision. And so the notion, I think, the conventional wisdom, whether true or not, is that Ed Murray would have more of a regional vision.
He says he does.
Yeah. But, you'd have to ask Mayor Stephenson of Everett or someone. But.
Well, so Eli and Joni, this week, the two men who would be mayor, Mr. Murray and Mr. McGinn, were busy trying to paint each other. I'm less business. You're more in the hands of business. McGinn got a big labor endorsement from the SEIU, and Murray, it's very ironic in a city where they're both Democrats, where, I don't know, 70% of the electorate is liberal, that, you know, one liberal could be less liberal than the other liberal. I mean, what is going on?
Well, they're trying to decide who's more liberal is really what they're battling over. And so even early on, as the race just took shape after the primary, Ed Murray, McGinn's folks were saying, is the establishment candidate. But then the dust-up this week had more to do with take a look at the spending on it, and it looks like both candidates are getting money from labor and both candidates are getting money from business, as you would expect, because, you know, they're both politically very similar. This is a fight in some ways about style, and so that's what you would expect.
Canute, were he here, would talk about McGinn being quite supportive of the development community. There's been a lot of development in South Lake Union. A lot of that was put underway before McGinn took office. I think Greg Nichols had that vision, but it's certainly not been stopped and has been supported, transit-oriented development, density supported by McGinn in his tenure. And so I find it very interesting to watch the dance that they're doing right now.
Well, you can be pro-growth and density and not be in the pocket of the business establishment and giving them carte blanche and everything they want. And I think that's what McGinn would argue, that he has supported smart growth in the city and in South Lake Union and, you know, worked on increasing or decreasing, I guess, the environmental footprint of this new building and also making the city more bike accessible, although there's been debate about how well he's done on that. But the larger debate that you were talking about a minute ago, I would kind of divide right now as who is more man of the people and who is not. And there's been a lot of talk about the precinct map that came out, I think it was last week,
right,
that showed really Murray winning all the neighborhoods, all the slices of neighborhoods with nice views. You know, you kind of can draw a ring around Seattle and look at any place that's on a bluff, on a hill, with a water view, in other words, more expensive, in other words, higher income Seattleites voting for Murray. And, you know, the Duwamish Basin, Georgetown, Beacon Hill, the kind of core of the city and the working class and more diverse parts of the city going toward McGinn.
Well, if you look back at that map, you'll also notice that Ed Murray did very well in West Seattle and throughout West Seattle, not just the part that has the better view. And significantly this week, City Council Member Bruce Harrell, who did very well in his own district of Southeast Seattle, his own area, it's not a district now, but his own area of Southeast Seattle, endorsed Ed Murray. And so I don't know if the endorsement brings everybody over to Ed Murray or if people say, well, Bruce Harrell, you lost, so I'll just vote however I choose to. But that is an area that's ripe, and it is not the wealthiest part of the city.
I'm just typing a message to Jason Pagano, our producer here, because he had a little question there. The other issue when we talk about the people, if you're not for McGinn, does that mean you're not a person? I mean, who are the people?
Well, the phrase man of the people is...
Right. What does that mean?
To me, it means, someone who is more of a champion of the working class, of the people who do
Those
not
people.
Have a lot of money to spend influencing politicians, to people who don't necessarily own large corporations. The majority of people is what that phrase means to me. And so, no, it's not that the people who vote for Murray are not people. And it's not that Murray doesn't have support, here and there throughout the city. But you look at that map and there is something quite striking about it. And so it suggests to me that however people are trying to frame this, this is an actual divide that exists. You can look at the map and see this. And whoever takes advantage of it most effectively, maybe has a better path toward being mayor. The question on West Seattle, and Joni makes a good point, I think some of that has to do with light rail and the feeling that the mayor has not solved the problem of how to get off of West Seattle without, driving over the bridge, which is every West Seattleite's nightmare during rush hour.
And it's going to be just worse and worse as the waterfront construction amps up, because it's already pretty crazy. Well, speaking of a man of the people, the former big dog, Bill Clinton, was trotted out this week. And as one NPR newscaster described it, put out a video where he described at length why people should, and he is lengthy, why that they should be signing up for the healthcare exchanges, why they should be supportive of the plan that we've now all come to call Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Somebody called him Clinton, not Obama, the explainer in chief. But he is also perceived, Eli, as much more of a populist than Barack Obama is.
And he did this in Arkansas, not the wealthiest state in the country and not the most supportive of Barack Obama. I think what I read was that the people in the Obama administration were looking at his speech at the Democratic National Convention, where he explained better than Obama the intricate policies that make the president a better choice, or made Obama a better choice than Romney. And so they're hoping that he can do that with healthcare reform, which is incredibly intricate and obviously an incredibly hard sell. We'll see how effective it is and how many people sit and watch a 50-minute speech on YouTube, although I think there will be high interest, and so maybe people will. Another thing that I've been thinking about while watching the healthcare rollout is how much it's being drowned out by the Syria debate.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
And I don't know yet whether that's to the administration's favor or not. It actually, in a lot of ways, takes the wind out of the sails of the opposition, who wanted to spend this month railing against Obamacare.
And now they have to talk about war instead. Well, here in the state of Washington, they're ramping up the call-in lines. And Ruby DeLuna, our healthcare reporter, said like it was open for business for an hour and they got 160 calls of people really curious. And we're going to be answering questions, by the way, on our show, The Record, next week. So if you've got a question, we're going to have experts try to demystify this for you, so you can email record@kuow.org. But that said, they've rolled out some plans and people are still confused. Do I qualify for the exchange? Do I qualify for a federal subsidy? I'm on Medicaid. What happens? I'm on Medicare. What happens? I have an employer who might pay. Are they supposed to pay? Are they going to pay? What do I do? I mean, money boils down.
Well, the number one feature of Obamacare from the very beginning, because it was such a big bill, it was 2,400 pages, if I remember correctly, was that people didn't understand it. Well, at 2,400 pages,
nobody probably read the whole thing.
Nobody read it. Who would understand all of it? And so it really has been an information vacuum for people trying to figure this out. It has a beginning date, October 1st.
Yep.
Guess what?
Right.
All of a sudden, that's coming soon.
Yep.
And so there have to be different ways to get information, the call-in line, the KOW program, and Bill Clinton, who is the unofficial ambassador for everything, apparently, because he can explain things very well. And the speech at the Democratic Convention was widely regarded as explaining just about everything Obama had done, including Obamacare. And for him to go and give this sort of long somewhat tortured explanation of how healthcare was going to work in a state like Arkansas was probably pretty helpful, but it is drowned out. It's not the number one story as it probably would have been because Syria has taken center stage.
It is nice that the Health Exchange website is actually fairly user-friendly.
Yes.
You put in what your income is, how many kids you have. It'll be an interesting gauge to see how many people actually use the website in the next month or so and how many do the call-in center, because it isn't especially friendly to people who aren't online and who are online competent. But
I do think there will be high motivation on the part of all citizens, really, to figure this out, because this is one of those things that now really impacts everyone's pocketbook, everyone's health. And almost everyone has a healthcare story that they can tell about being dissatisfied with their coverage or shocked at how expensive it was. And so there's like I said, high motivation to get in there and figure it out. And hopefully people will be able to.
Now, last and very least, but sort of interesting, the new owner of the Washington Post went to address his troops, and he told them, all businesses need to be young forever. If your customer base ages with you, then you turn into Woolworth, said Bezos. So he's challenging the Washington Post editorial staff to never be dull and vows to invest in it. Can he make it work?
He won them over. Every account that I've read,
really?
As he went in there, and they were skeptical, you know, what's this guy going to do? He won them over. He had some very interesting things to say. Never be boring.
Yeah.
Access to a newspaper should be as easy as buying a pack of diapers, I guess it is, on Amazon. And he had some fresh ideas about how people would buy newspaper products. They won't buy one story, he said. They'll buy a habit?
A bundle, yeah.
A daily ritual bundle. Thank you. And so he had some ideas, and he went in, and, you know, it could have gone either way, but it seemed to have gone his way.
So you three are newspaper people. Is this good news for your industry, or is this just isolated to the one guy, one newspaper?
Well, you really have to wait and see whether it is good news and whether he has the answer that no one else has been able to come up with yet. But in terms of winning people over, it must be so refreshing for the people in the Post newsroom to have someone come in with optimism after their last owners, after trying so hard, said, we can't figure this out and we're not sure anyone can. And for journalists across the country, that's been the situation. So to have someone say this can be done is exciting.
Eli Sanders is associate editor for The Stranger. Joni Balter, assistant political editor for The Seattle Times. And Peter Jackson, editorial page editor for the Everett Herald. It's been great having you in here the past couple of weeks.
Thank you.
We'll have you back.
And, you know, we were owned by The Washington Post until February.
Oh, well, then you don't get any of the Bezos largesse.
Alas. Yeah.
I'm Marcy Silman. Our show is produced by Jason Pagano. Bernard Ouellette, as always, our brilliant and steadfast engineer. Join us next Friday at 10 o'clock here on 94.9 KUOW.
degrees in Seattle with lots of clouds in the sky and with showers in the forecast. It's going to be rain at times until this afternoon. That'll taper off. We're going to hit a high today of 67.
Support for KUOW comes from the merchants at SeaTac Airport, including Runway Grill in the South Satellite, featuring a selection of homestyle burgers, hot dogs, and salads for travel. Information on SeaTac merchants' mileage plan participation at SeaTacShops.com.
This week in This American Life, Michael Lewis tells the incredible story of how a teenage boy made it into college, into Harvard no less, thanks to a stolen library book in another language, and real essays and emails sent to college admissions officers, including one from a parent that begins, "My second grader has decided on a career in electrical engineering. He is leaning towards MIT. As schools start, how I got into college, this week."
You'll hear that exactly 24 hours from now,